You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 23rd of June 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily. We're live here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in today's programme...
This is Al Jazeera.
Qatar is given an ultimatum to close down its starred broadcaster Al Jazeera amid a diplomatic row. We'll look at the media outlet's future. Also ahead, India's Prime Minister is off to Washington, but how will he get on with Donald Trump? Plus, after a pint of fire wine and a barrel of herring, our woman in Stockholm explains the allure of a Swedish midsummer. And a bit later on, we'll tour New York's Metrograph Cinema, one of the world's most beautiful.
We've had remarkably stylish audiences and remarkably, frankly, romantic audiences. A lot of dates happening here, and that's a way that I've always thought about this project from the very beginning, was that this is a place that you can actually go on a date to the movies.
All that, plus the Asian newspapers, war and peace in Afghanistan, and we find out why France's new president is taking so long to release his official portrait. That's all coming up on the Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson. But before that, a quick look at the day's other top stories. Donald Trump has raised questions over whether the man investigating Russia's interference in the US election can carry out his duties without bias. The president says Robert Mueller's friendship with the former FBI director James Comey is bothersome. It's understood the president has become a focus of the investigation for possible obstruction of justice. Investigators say a fire that engulfed the Grenfell Tower apartment block in London started in a fridge freezer. The building's outside cladding and insulation also failed safety tests. The building is believed to have killed 79 people, with 151 homes destroyed. The European Council President Donald Tusk says he's concerned the British Prime Minister's plan to safeguard the rights of EU citizens after Britain's exit from the Union may jeopardise their situation. Speaking to reporters shortly after a meeting in Brussels, Mr. Tusk says his first impression was that the UK's offer was below expectations. And Germany's Social Democratic Party has pledged to introduce same-sex marriage within their first 100 days in office, should they win September's election. The party's secretary General Hubertus Heil described the failure of Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats to support equal marriage as completely backwards. And those are the headlines. Welcome to Studio One. This is the Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson. It has asked questions other Arab news outlets would not dare, interviewed guests considered terrorists by some nations, and has offered a view on Arab affairs and indeed the rest of the world right into the heart of households everywhere. But Al Jazeera has now become part of the bargaining game between its parent country Qatar and Saudi Arabia. If the blockade on Qatar is to be lifted, the television station must go. Well, Jocelyn Sage-Mitchell is assistant professor in residence at Northwestern University in Qatar, and she joins us now. Jocelyn, a very warm welcome to the programme. What is it that Al Jazeera has been able to offer that no one else has?
Hi, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate being here. You know, now that we have this list of demands, I think we see how frightened Al Jazeera makes countries like Saudi Arabia and these other authoritarian countries. To really understand these 13 demands, we have to understand the future political reality that this bloc of authoritarian countries blockading Qatar is trying to avoid. And one of the biggest things that they're trying to avoid is the rise of alternative social and political opinions by labeling any viewpoint they disagree with as terrorism or fake news. And I think that we see the demand to close Al Jazeera, as well as the other demand to close all the other news sources that Qatar is affiliated with, as an attempt of these authoritarian countries to avoid a future political reality of independent politics and multiple points of view.
It is that multiple point of view which has so irked so many countries, isn't it? It has a very disruptive nature about it. And arguably, when it started to report the Arab Spring as events were unfolding, it had its card marked from that point on.
Well, yes, it's funny that you say disruptive. I mean, it's open and contentious debate. alternative opinions. This is often something that isn't seen in this region's media sources. You know, it may seem as though Al Jazeera is under siege now, and perhaps because of the Arab Spring, but really, it's always been operating underneath this siege mentality and having the larger neighbors surrounding it unhappy with its points of view. It began as a direct competitor to Saudi Arabia's NBC channel. This was the first Arab satellite TV network, and it was the only pan-Arab TV voice until Al Jazeera started in 96. And Al Jazeera has really been a thorn in the side of these authoritarian countries in the Middle East ever since. It removed Saudi Arabia's monopoly on information. It allowed for this kind of debate on important issues, social and political. And as you said, most recently, it did give a mouthpiece to the ordinary people on the street calling for democracy during the Arab Spring revolutions that began in 2011. And this really frightened these entrenched authoritarian rulers. They have always wanted Al Jazeera closed since it began, but even more urgently now because they feel politically insecure and threatened by these alternative viewpoints.
It is as simple as that they feel threatened by it. I mean, it must be one of those things that as soon as Saudi Arabia realised that it could hold Qatar to ransom, surely it would be absolutely clear that Al Jazeera would have to be on the cards. What can Qatar and indeed Al Jazeera say in return to keep it going?
Wow. Well, you know, something that I've been really happy about is the fact that it doesn't just have to be Qatar and Al Jazeera saying, let us keep going. There's an increased worldwide recognition about the quality of journalism that Al Jazeera is providing to millions of people in the region and really around the world. I mean, if your viewers haven't checked it out yet, aljazeera.com, it does excellent Al Jazeera English reporting. And there's also the Al Jazeera Arabic news outlet. The New York Times, for example, recently did a supportive editorial noting that they maintain international journalistic standards and they serve as a vital news source for millions of people who live under anti-democratic rule. I mean, both Al Jazeera Arabic and Al Jazeera English, they serve two very different audiences, but they're, in my opinion, they're both crucial news sources for alternative viewpoints and open debate in a part of the world that often has very little of either. To be honest, it's a testament to the strength of Qatar, politically and socially, that the country supports this kind of journalism. So it shouldn't just be Qatar and Al Jazeera that are saying, hey, don't shut us down. We in the Western world should really all be behind the kind of work that Al Jazeera does and stand together to protect it from these authoritarian countries who want to shut down freedoms of speech, press, and democratic voice.
It is arguably one of Qatar's great soft power tools. It has allowed free speech in a time, as you have just described, when that was in an area where that is not necessarily all guaranteed. When Qatar is diplomatically on the back foot, which is, I think, is an understatement to describe what its situation is at the moment, what other countries can actually wade to its rescue?
That's an interesting question. To be honest, I think Qatar is standing on its own two feet right now. It's been so resilient over the past 2 weeks. I think this was a surprise, not only to maybe the entire world, but I think to the countries that are blockading it. I think they thought Qatar would crumble pretty quickly. I don't think they thought out the long-term implications of this, but I think Qatar is resilient precisely because it has so many friends in so many different places. I mean, the U.S. has actually been an extremely strong supporter of Qatar. The State Department has issued a very strongly worded statements in support of Qatar, and so has our Pentagon. And I know that Turkey and Iran have been very clear allies. Kuwait and Oman, as its neighbors in the GCC, have been very helpful as well. So we actually see quite a lot of, I think, the power that Qatar has been building over the years simply by attempting to make broad ties with many different countries and regions of the world. And I mean, let's not forget they export a third of the world's liquefied natural gas. So they're pretty important to a lot of people around the world. They have a lot of friends.
As a result, how long do you think it will be before Al Jazeera actually has to change the way that it operates. It has this popular swell behind it, but it is not without its imperfections. Its Arabic outlet has often been accused of being anti-Semitic, of being partisan. There's very little criticism of the Qatari monarchy itself. So there is some wriggle room for Al Jazeera to change and you know, effectively guarantee its success. But gaze into your crystal ball, would you please, Jocelyn, and tell us what you think is going to happen.
Unfortunately, these 13 demands are shocking and unreasonable. It's not just about Al Jazeera. All 13 of these demands are really unfortunate because unlike what the State Department was hoping for, unlike what I'm sure the mediators were hoping for, Kuwait and Turkey, among others, these are not demands that can be taken seriously and that can easily be fixed, especially with the end of Ramadan and the beginning of the Eid holiday and a 10-day deadline. I mean, this is definitely not going to happen. So this was an unfortunate day in terms of those who were hoping for a speedy resolution to this. I think we're just entering a stalemate at this point. The Qatari ministry has made it clear that they're open for negotiation, but that the negotiation cannot start until the blockade and embargo of their country is lifted. And it doesn't appear as though the authoritarian countries behind this block are interested in lifting that embargo anytime soon. So I think we're at a stalemate for a while now.
And if Al Jazeera were to go, newsrooms have a reputation of being quite resilient and springing up in other places with the same journalists and same teams, but with different branding and an amazing, clever new ident. Could you see that happening to Al Jazeera?
That's interesting. That's actually how Al Jazeera started. You know, it was originally a joint venture between Saudi Arabia's Orbit Satellite and the BBC Arabic World Service. And Saudi suddenly canceled this joint venture after only 2 short years when the new channel decided to do something that was unprecedented, which was host members of the Saudi opposition on a news program in 96. And these hundreds of trained journalists and staff members were suddenly out of a job, and Qatar hired them all and started Al Jazeera with them. So you're right that this does have precedence, but I don't think, as long as Qatar continues to support Al Jazeera, the network will continue to survive. I mean, Egypt, Saudi, the UAE, and Bahrain have canceled Al Jazeera's media license. They've censored the website online, but the network continues to operate in almost all the other countries of the region. And of course, it's reachable online anywhere in the world, both English and Arabic. So I don't think that that Al Jazeera is going to be shut down by Qatar. I guess that's my crystal ball prediction.
Thank you very much indeed, Jocelyn Sage-Mitchell from Northwestern University. We shall no doubt be revisiting you in the next few weeks to find out what happens to Al Jazeera. You're listening to Monocle 24. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. We're live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. It is almost 16 years since coalition forces entered Afghanistan with the intention of ridding the country of al-Qaeda and toppling the Taliban. Now the Taliban, still there, have said that the only way Afghanistan will ever see peace is if US forces leave. Well, Matthew Green is a journalist and author who's worked in Afghanistan. He's a Monocle 24 regular, and I'm delighted to say he's in the studio now. Welcome, Matthew. Just if you could contextualise the extent of the United States presence and its current effect, what is it still doing there, and why are the Taliban getting so cross that they're still there?
Well, there are still approximately 8,500 US troops who are engaged in Afghanistan. They're mainly in training roles or working in various core headquarters with the Afghan National Army, although there are, of course, special forces engaged in counterterrorism missions as well. But it's a far cry from the peak of the US deployment a few years ago, back in 2010, 2011, when there were more than 100,000 US troops in the country. And of course, the debate now is very much in Washington about what should be done. Should the US deploy more troops again and try to push the Taliban back? But really, there are no good answers.
Therefore, how right is the Taliban for saying that United States forces' departure will actually bring a more peaceable life to Afghanistan?
I think that the subtext of the message is that the departure of US forces would allow them to sweep into provincial capitals and hopefully take Kabul at some stage. I mean, they're banking that the Afghan National Army and police would crumble without US logistical support and all the intelligence and airstrikes and other assets that the US bring to the table. Obviously, the US aren't going to withdraw, and the Taliban, it should be said, have been demanding this pretty much since the first cruise missiles started raining down on Kandahar in October 2001. So it's not news, but certainly we're at a very interesting juncture in Afghanistan. Donald Trump, US president, has delegated authority to the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, the former general, to decide what to do about troop numbers. So we can expect Afghanistan to be in the news a lot more, I think, in the next few weeks than it has been for some time.
And indeed, you know, the timing of the Taliban's request is unusual, given the fact that it is but a few weeks since James Mattis and indeed the US forces out in Afghanistan said, we actually need more soldiers, not fewer.
Yeah.
And also, they're busy trying to drop the world's largest bomb and IS bunkers as well.
The MOAB. The mother of all bombs. Yes, well, that was a few months ago that happened, wasn't it? And it was the biggest weapon basically ever deployed by the US military since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I think the point about on the military side is that there's a real split now in the particularly between sort of US diplomats and US military over what should be done. James Mattis is obviously a military man, and if all you have is a hammer, then every problem is likely to look like a nail. He wants more troops to coordinate airstrikes, to play a more aggressive role in the field in mentoring Afghan troops. But really, you have to ask the question whether that's going to be enough to make a real strategic impact. And I think it was one of the former US ambassadors to the region who said it looks like America once again has tactics, but no strategy.
Afghanistan has a difficult game to play here, doesn't it? Well, the Taliban indeed, because it is a country which receives aid from Pakistan, has been, you know, it gets help from Russia in certain subjects. It is not a country which turns down help from everybody.
No, I mean, well, certainly the role of, you mentioned the role of Pakistan.
Which is complicated.
Well, it's very complicated, yes. Obviously, Pakistan has a long history of supporting the Taliban and other factions fighting in Afghanistan. And we've also heard allegations more recently that Russia has been providing support to the Taliban, also along with Iran. So it was called the Great Game in the 19th century, and it's still very much, the game is still very much on. And China obviously has a strategic role there too. So what role America will carve out for itself or envisage, I guess, is the big question. And with Donald Trump in the White House, I suppose anything is possible.
Well, let's try and narrow that anything down a little bit. What options do the United States now have?
Well, there's obviously no appetite for flooding Afghanistan with tens of thousands more troops. I think James Mattis's plan is quite clear. He testified before the Senate just a few weeks ago, saying that he wants to get more. He's not wanting to send infantry battalions to kind of fight the Taliban in the green zones of Helmand and Kandahar. He wants special forces who are going to be very precisely embedded with Afghan army units to multiply their effectiveness and try to put the Taliban on the back foot. Because I mean, you have to remember that the real sort of subtext to this is that there's a fear that the Afghan government of President Ashraf Ghani could actually collapse. And if the government is already subject to a very tenuous power sharing agreement, which emerged out of the last elections, it's very fragile. There's been mounting ethnic tension and sectarian tension in Kabul. The place is a powder keg. And of course, if the government starts to fall apart, then the Afghan National Army will crack apart very quickly too. And we could be looking at a really genuinely catastrophic situation in Afghanistan. America doesn't want that to happen. However much Trump was against America's interventions overseas, however much his advisors like Steve Bannon are nationalists who just don't want America to be involved, nobody across the political spectrum wants to see America's years and years of investment in Afghanistan literally going up in smoke.
How much willingness is there? Clearly, we've heard that the Taliban aren't keen, but from the Afghan government itself, whatever state it may be,
yeah.
I mean, how welcome is the US?
Well, Ashraf Ghani is a former World Bank technocrat. He's spent many years in the US. He's absolutely desperate for more US support to try to turn the tide militarily. I mean, let's remember that the Taliban control up to 40% of territory in Afghanistan. And in the last year or two, they've been making these extremely bold forays into provincial capitals, which was unheard of a few years before. So he's in a very fragile, vulnerable position, and obviously will be very eager to get more US backing. I think the bigger question as well on the US side is Trump has more or less delegated decision-making authority in Afghanistan to James Mattis. And that's a huge shift from the Obama years when there was endless scrutiny of almost every tiny pawn being moved across the chessboard by the generals in Afghanistan. What that means going forward for civil-military relations in America, I think, is really interesting too. So there's a lot more at stake here than just the future of Afghanistan, you know, as crucial as that is.
So when will we be having this conversation in 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, four
well,
years?
Well, that's the
time?
Thing. I mean, it was funny just reading some of the stories a few minutes ago. You just think this is just like being in 2010, and the same debates, the same dilemmas, the same dynamics at play. And it really is very difficult to see that there's an easy way out for the US here. Really difficult.
Matthew Green, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're listening to the Monocle Daily. We're live on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. And what can the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi hope to achieve during his visit to Washington? His host at the White House, no doubt, has plenty else on his mind. Well, Shashank Joshi is Senior Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and he joins me now on the line. Shashank, a very warm welcome to the programme. Straight away, what is Prime Minister Modi helping to get out of his trip?
Well, I mean, the US and India have had a phenomenal development of their relationship over the past 10 years, notably in defense engagement, defense sales, but also, you know, across the board, economics, diplomacy, global governance. And I think the Indians are slightly concerned that under Trump, a man who looks to see what he can get out of any relationship, whether that's with an ally or an adversary, they're worried that momentum will be completely disrupted. So this is the first meeting between the two men, both of them, you know, pretty sort of nationalistic, strong leaders who portray very muscular visions of themselves in their domestic politics. I think just to set an even keel at the beginning and smooth out some differences on issues like visas, particularly skilled visas for Indian technology workers in America, and on a few other things like climate change, where Trump blamed India for seeking billions and billions of aid and issues like that.
Well, we'll get to climate change in a minute, because this is a sort of a key issue. But let's examine first the personalities of Modi and Trump. Modi has been described by commentators who weren't necessarily being terribly nice about him as belonging to a class of populist, electable, narcissistic right-wing autocrats who appeal is that they pander to majoritarian anger. Now, you could apply that arguably to both men. And we've seen in the past, Donald Trump gets on with the likes of Xi Jinping, a sort of a big power guy. He likes to hook up with fellow sort of like big personality leaders. Are we expecting great things from this meeting?
I think there's certainly a commonality. I wouldn't necessarily call Modi autocratic. He has a very commanding democratic mandate, but I think many of those other words are quite appropriate. And you're absolutely right. Trump has a respect for those who have power and are willing to use it, whether that's autocratic or democratic. And I think we've seen that, as you say, not just with Xi Jinping, but also with Vladimir Putin, with President al-Sisi, with King Salman of Saudi Arabia. And I think that Modi, what characterizes him is that he's a very smooth operator. He's very good at projecting warmth and friendship. And I've seen him, you know, we've seen him do it with Shinzo Abe of Japan. We've seen him do it with Barack Obama, even giving him a big bear hug when they first met. And I think he'll be very good at pushing Trump's buttons, not just projecting himself as a strong nationalist leader, but also more than that, I think flattering Trump. I think picking on the issues where they have commonalities, such as fighting Islamic extremism. And I think Modi will try and rope in Pakistan into that discussion. So I think they'll try and avoid the contentious subject. And I think Modi will probably be quite good at persuading Trump to like him.
I wonder how much Donald Trump will actually understand about the situations that Modi plants on his doorstep.
Well, I think the answer, I think we know, we both know the answer is probably incredibly little. Just as Trump understood very little of the issues around Qatar, the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran. And yet, despite knowing very little and having very, you know, a legion of advisors, still was perfectly willing to be roped into a major regional Cold War just because King Salman and now Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman were willing to tell them his and their side of the story and persuaded Trump that what they were asking him to do and that their own regional interests were effectively coterminous with U.S. counterterrorism interests. And I think Modi will hope to do the same. He'll say, look, Pakistan is a terrorist state. I'm fighting terrorists. You're fighting terrorists. Let's do great things together. And of course, in Pakistan, they'll be rather worried about that. And we'll try and have an alternative story, which is to say, Kashmir is disputed. No one has been able to solve it. But you, President Trump, you, the great deal maker, only you could solve this. And of course, there'll be this competing effort, I think, to try and prey on his vulnerabilities.
As a result, what do you think Donald Trump will do in all this?
Well, it's difficult to say, of course, because he does still have, a Secretary of Defense and a Secretary of State, James Mattis and Rex Tillerson, who are much more orthodox in their views. And the U.S.-India relationship is something that, in a way, goes beyond the personality of the president. It's partly about balancing against the rise of China, about allying with the biggest democracy in the world and a rising power, perhaps the world's biggest democratic rising power, and some country which will undoubtedly dominate the Indian Ocean for decades to come. And I think they will push Trump in that direction.
One thing that you mentioned a moment ago, and I said we would come to, is the commitment to climate change that Narendra Modi has. That was arguably a product of an unusually good relationship with Donald Trump's predecessor. I mean, there are astonishing photographs of Trump and Obama sitting, drinking coffee outdoors, both laughing their heads off. As you said, Prime Minister Modi gave Obama a bear hug the first time he met him. How much will that actually grate with Donald Trump?
I don't think he'll have much of a knowledge or memory of that. I think what will grate is this perception in his head that India is perhaps one of those countries that is, as he says, making fun of the United States, effectively milking the United States, asking for billions in aid in what the word is, I think, climate mitigation finance, just to sign up to emissions reductions that should be doing anyway. And I think that's the kind of thing that really irritates him. But of course, what Modi will try and point out is to say, you know, look, not only is that untrue, but also we are giving you billions of dollars in terms of all the arms that we're buying. And indeed, we've just seen the latest deal, which may be announced on this visit on the weekend, is the State Department has authorized the sale of 22 Predator drones, unarmed Predator drones, to India, which will be a huge deal. You know, it'll be $2 billion or so in the deal itself. And I think that he'll try and say, whatever the past, whatever you think about us on climate change or on outsourcing or taking American jobs, we are pumping money into the U.S. economy, and therefore we are helping to make America great again. And I think that's the kind of message we'll see him drive home on the weekend.
Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. Bomber. most of us in the Northern Hemisphere will have been perhaps grateful to have seen sundown on midsummer. In Sweden, it is a much more elaborate affair. Elna Nukkanen Andersson is Monocle's Stockholm correspondent, and she has taken time out from her barbecue on an island near to Stockholm in the archipelago to tell us exactly why the Swedes go so bananas at this time of year. Elna, a very warm welcome to the programme. There's about 12 of you just about to light up the barbecue, so I won't keep you for too long. But what is it about midsummer and the Swedes?
Well, where shall I start? It's one of the biggest celebrations of the whole year, and it's kind of start of the summer season. Just a couple of weeks ago, all the schools, you know, finished their school year. A lot of people are beginning their annual holidays now, so it's kind of, you know, the big start of the summer. And of course, you know, the time when there's most light, so the day is the longest as it gets. So, you know, up in northern Sweden, there's basically, you know, no darkness at all. And even here in the southern part where I am, or sort of in the, you know, middle of Sweden, we get about 19 hours of sunlight. So it's just a time to get together, and a lot of people celebrate with their families, but you can also just share this time with your friends.
What is it about the fact that it is, you've only got, 5 hours of darkness? But when you look at what the Swedes seem to be getting up to around this time of year, it seems to involve a lot of dancing in fields and putting flowers on your head. How accurate a portrayal of your great country is that?
It's a very fun party, because it's kind of a playful time for adults and kids alike. It's kind of a time to let loose, you know. Like today, people traditionally start with a lunch. So you have herring and schnapps and the singing and all of that. And then after that, you have the games. Like we've had a pentathlon with 5 different events, you know, involving stuff like, you know, running with a potato and a spoon and jumping in a bag and, you know, ice hockey and football and stuff like that. So it's a family event. It's just a fun, very fun party, as opposed to, you know, maybe, you know, some other family gatherings that can be much more serious. It's kind of, you know, maybe not such an accurate portrayal of Sweden as a whole, but it's just a time to let loose and sort of have fun.
I mean, those games wouldn't look a million miles out of place at a children's sports day, and yet everyone, right up to grandma, gets in the bag and has a bounce.
Yes. Yeah, that's the greatness of it. You know, that adults also can let loose and, you know, have fun like that. And what I like about it is that you do it together. So it's not just the kids, you know, everyone gets there. It's not too serious. And, you know, it looks pretty funny, to be honest.
So what are your plans this evening then?
Well, as you said, we're lighting up the barbecue now. We had a minor catastrophe there because the gas in the barbecue ran out. So we had to, like, perform an operation there and fill up with some more gas, but that's fine now, so we're just gonna fix that and otherwise stay up as late as we can and, you know, sing and have some more snacks, I think.
And is there any possibility that there'll be a maypole involved? And indeed, apparently it is not unheard of people to dance like frogs.
Yeah, it's getting a bit late for maypole for us, to be honest. Most people have had theirs already. It's something you do kind of around lunch, and then you do the frog dance around it. But, you know, who knows? Maybe some people will feel an inspiration and start building one.
Have some more schnapps and we'll find out later. Elna Nukkanen Andersson in Stockholm, celebrating midsummer for us so we don't have to. Thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. Now for this week's edition of a new sister show of our weekly film programme, The Cinema Show. It's called Action, but it has an exclamation mark at the end of it. So I shall shout, Action! Or Action! Exclamation mark. Anyway, with its exposed brick walls, custom red chairs and lush indoor greenery, New York's Metrograph Cinema is one of the world's most beautifully designed independent cinemas. And we take a seat for this week's episode of Action with founder and designer Alexander Olch.
Yeah, so this will be a private dining room here. This is a great place. This will be open for breakfast and lunch too, so the skylight, whole situation. And then this
New York is a city of great cinemas, and some people might argue that there doesn't need to be a new cinema. So tell me, what inspired you to do this? Is it a love of movies, or that you felt there was something missing?
Well, I grew up on this island and fell in love with making movies in large part because of the places that I went to see them when I was little. Places like the Beekman, the Plaza, the Ziegfeld, which are now literally all gone. And one part of this idea was to try to reclaim some of that special glamour magic that I'd felt as a little boy going to those places, where even before the movie started, you could feel that something special happened inside. The other part of this idea is that this is a place you would really come to even if you weren't going to see a movie. And that is something I had not felt in the city, is to have a place with our bookstore, our candy store, two bars, restaurant, that this is a place where people are going to come open for breakfast and lunch and have meetings, write their screenplays, be a part of a movie experience that extends beyond the actual cinema rooms.
I was speaking to one of your colleagues a moment ago, and he said something very interesting, that part of this is reclaiming that magic of kind of going to the theater, what that used to be that is in some ways lost now, but also building something that's a way forward and what people want to experience when they do go to the cinema. So can you talk to me about that?
Well, I was very, very excited when I saw we opened the theater about 10 days ago. So we're about on the 11th day in. We had a 11 p.m. screening of Masculin Femina, and I was thrilled to see what basically was a packed house of dates and people, very, I have to say, stylish group of people. I was not necessarily expecting that at a repertory cinema. And we've had remarkably stylish audiences and remarkably, frankly, romantic audiences. A lot of dates happening here. And that's a way that I've always thought about this project from the very beginning, was that this is a place that you can actually go on a date to the movies, which I felt was starting to slip away a little bit in New York City. That there is something special about coming to see a film, and there are the finer details of the chair you sit in, the decor of the room, but the overall feeling of the place, what it stands for, the kind of programming that we do, that it's something that feels special that you might just get a little dressed up to come to.
I would love to talk about actually those finer details. Everything is incredibly beautiful. As you said, the chairs have a wooden back. The fonts that you used are beautiful. You can peek into the screening room upstairs. You have a beautiful balcony. Every detail is really wonderful. And talk to me about those choices that you made and just describe them to me.
Well, I guess, I mean, it's a strange project in the sense that I am a filmmaker and I've now designed a movie theater. So I've really approached this project, which has taken 6 years, really in the same way that I would a movie, which is the accumulation of massive amounts of detailed decisions, from the chairs, which are made from the very same beams of the Domino Sugar Factory. So when they demoed the Domino Sugar Factory, we got our hands on the roof beams, and these chairs are hand milled into my own design of a chair. I was presented by architects and engineers catalogs of ready-made chairs, which I promptly closed those catalogs and said, I think we're going to do our own thing. Yeah, so the chairs are one particular idea. They, in there, we're sitting in them right now in Theater 2. The velvet armrest, the velvet back, and the velvet seats, combined with this old-growth pine, has a certain sense, I think, of glamour. At the same time, we're on a concrete floor, and there are some very honest details of being in a warehouse on Ludlow Street in Chinatown in Manhattan. And for me, a lot of the decisions here have been creating a world of contrast, of trying to have key items that speak of a certain glamour from an era that maybe is gone, and ideas that are very much now, that are sort of very simple. And so I guess you might call it a low-key glamour, sort of an honest glamour. So there's no real quotation marks here. It's not trying to be nostalgic just for the sake of nostalgia. It's simply trying to create a certain sense of formality and classiness about the space and excitement about the space from all of the details that we've created, from the type styles to the menus to the marquee, which is made of special wood letters with magnets, which was kind of a crazy design idea. Every single thing here, for better or worse, has been thought through very, very carefully.
I can't help but kind of think about, to me, this area, which is very hip in New York. It's a really cool area. But there's this kind of culture to embrace casual dressing, and that it really is epitomized in this neighborhood. But as you said, those people are really coming to the cinema and drawn to this kind of glamour. So I wonder if you can speak to that at all.
Well, I think for me, what's interesting is contrast. I also am a fashion designer and have a store right around the corner that sells quite formal things, neckties, pajamas, and shirts, and sits in a neighborhood that, as you said, might not be exactly the neighborhood you'd expect such a sort of formal shop to be in. And I think it's the contrasts that are the most interesting, especially when handled in the kind of low-key way that I'm trying to do here, which is that it's very approachable and yet still something special. And so the result, one of the nice compliments I've heard is when people come in here, they say, I'm not even sure where I am. Am I still, you know, in Manhattan? I don't know where I am. And they're talking something about place. They're talking something about time. They're talking something about just the light in some ways, that there is a little bit of a transformation as you come into this space, that you really do feel like you've stepped into a slightly different world, hopefully a world that you want to hang out in for a while.
And that was designer Alexander Olch on this week's edition of Action! Exclamation mark, the new bite-sized sister show to The Cinema Show. Coming up on Monocle 24, it's the Asian newspapers.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatised am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had
today.
A debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
It's time now for the Asian newspapers, looking ahead to the weekend. I'm joined in the studio by none other than John Everard, former ambassador to North Korea and Monocle 24 regular. Welcome back, John. Okay, where are we going to start?
Well, let's start with things that might make you laugh out loud, a subject we were discussing off-air just now. And North Korea has offered a rare example of just such a text. It's put out a statement on the tragic death of Otto Warmbier, who, as you recall, was in North Korean custody for 17 months and came back to his parents just in time to die following effectively an arrest of oxygen to the brain, the stuck cause of which has never actually been ascertained. The North Koreans today have put out a statement saying that they don't know what happened to him, and that they are the victims in all this, and that it's all the fault of President Obama, which would be hilarious if it wasn't so cynical and if it wasn't associated with such a tragic case. Of course, I spent a long time listening to North Korean alternative facts of various kinds, and I suppose, and to an extent, I'm inured to them. But you know, even to an old, leathery-skinned lag like me, this statement really does take the biscuit. Of course they know what happened. It's just they are too frightened to say it. And of course they are not the victims in this. They are the perpetrators, and they need the finger to be pointed at them.
It is astonishing. It says, although we had no reason at all to show mercy to such a criminal of the enemy state, we provided him with medical treatment and care with all sincerity on a humanitarian basis until his return to the US. And then it says, to make it clear, we are the biggest victim of this incident, and there would be no more foolish judgment than to think we do not know how to calculate gains and losses. There's a surprising amount of self-awareness in that statement, isn't there? We don't know how to calculate gains and losses.
Yes, there is.
That is what sort of strikes you slightly, doesn't it?
Yes, there's self-awareness, which is always encouraging. Also, self-awareness of a different kind, the idea that you are the victim. This is the kind of whining tone that you get in so many North Korean statements. The world is against us. We are always the victims, even when clearly, in this case, they are not. Did they give him medical attention? They probably did. I suspect that what happened was that something went horribly wrong very early on in his detention, in which case those in charge of his custody would have done everything in their power to try to bring him round. Of course, as we know, they failed miserably. But the idea that this in any way exonerates North Korea is, of course, preposterous. North Korea has presided over the death of a perfectly healthy 22-year-old, and I think they owe everybody an explanation.
There is always an opportunity, whether guided or otherwise, to make a political capital out of this. How has the rest of the region reacted to it?
Variously. The South Korean press, of course, has had a field day. This is North Korea at its idiotic worst. The Chinese, interestingly, they've printed the North Korean statement, but they have left out the bit about North Korea saying that they are the victim. That was just too much, even for the Chinese to stomach.
Okay, let's move on to your next story. Let's head to Kashmir. Awful story.
Yes, an awful story. Friday prayers at the central mosque, the Jama Masjid in Srinagar, and one of the insurgent, as the Indians call him, independent leaders, was about to preach, Mujahid Farooq, who's quite well known to the authorities. And as a result of this, the Indian police had undercover agents staking the play out, seeing who was going in and out. Unfortunately, one of them, a detective superintendent, who probably should have known better, was caught by two or three worshippers taking photographs. They expressed anger at what he was doing, and in circumstances which have not been fully explained, he drew a pistol and shot two of them. Immediately, a mob jumped on him, stripped him naked, and stoned him to death. So a lynching, effectively. The first lynching of a policeman in Kashmir since the disturbances began. So very bad news. It's going to get worse. The Indian police are, I suppose, understandably outraged that one of their own has been killed in this way. They've arrested two people. They say they've identified and are looking for a third. No sense in any of the Indian police statements of an awareness of the risk that this is going to escalate out of control. A province of India that is already on the brink, where senior academics have suggested that India is losing control. And this is just the kind of incident that would add a spark to a prairie.
What actually would a police officer have been doing around there?
He was photographing people. He was trying to see who was going in and out, presumably on the lookout for terrorists. The Indian police statement talks about the need to protect worshippers against miscreants who might vitiate the atmosphere. Quite what vitiating the atmosphere might mean, I think we have to guess.
It's unusual because just looking at the article that you've brought into us on the New India Express website, it talks about whether the slain officer was there for the security of a conference chairman who delivers sermons at the mosque. I mean, is that something
that's Miraj Farooq, yes.
Is that going to be plausible? And if so, is that a helpful situation to encourage, to have security by the police provided?
To have security by the police provided, where you're looking at the personal security of the preacher, yes. It's perhaps a little more inflammatory to have undercover police taking pictures, although you can fully understand why they did this. The Kashmir, as I said, is in a very fragile state. But clearly, the people who attacked the policemen felt that what they were doing was denigrated a respected leader, and they acted accordingly.
Let's move on to the Straits Times. They have the jailing of a friend, or the friend, of Park Geun-hye, the disgraced ex-leader. Tell us a little bit more what is happening in this story, which has gone away after Park Geun-hye's departure has gone from the presidential palace, but clearly justice is being seen to be done.
Well, yes, it's gone away because it's taken the investigators a while to bring the case and to put them through the court. Essentially, there are three big fish in this case. Park Geun-hye herself, of course, Lee Jae-woong, who's the head of, the heir apparent of the vast Samsung industrial empire, and Choi Soon-sil, who was the confidant of Park Geun-hye, who was at the heart of the scandals. Much talk of illicit access to government documents, helping to write speeches and other things that no unbriefed and uncleared person should have been able to do. Today, she has been formally found guilty of using her influence to secure preferential treatment for her daughter at Ewha University, which is one of the most prestigious universities in South Korea, suggesting that she illicitly gained admission for her daughter and got them to fiddle her daughter's grades. There's a 3-year prison sentence. This is just the beginning. There are still many more serious charges against her, everything from fraud through to conspiracy, which will carry much heavier jail terms. And verdicts have not been handed down on Lee Jae-woong or on Park Geun-hye herself.
Okay, let us move on to something. I think after a week of, or a good few months, or indeed years of bitterly nasty news, we're going to have Panda Cub Corner.
We have got Panda Cub Corner, indeed. Pandas, of course, a very rare creature. The Chinese counted that there are only 1,864 of them in the wild throughout the whole of China. That there is a sanctuary for them in Shaanxi province, which has a couple of dozen pandas, and who are having a bit of a panda cub field day. Last week, one of the females there, a panda called Yang Yang, gave birth to a healthy young male cub, and the very next day, another female panda gave birth to male twins. So we have three panda cubs in a matter of days. The authorities must be over the moon. Better still, there are two other heavily pregnant female pandas about to deliver. So yes, panda cubs all round.
Wonderful. Thank you very much indeed, John Everard with the Asian newspapers and Panda News. And finally, tonight in town halls across France, there's a funny gap on the wall where paint and wallpaper had been protected by the official portrait of the previous president, François Hollande. No replacement has yet been issued. In some cases, he's still there, staring out haplessly from the garden of the Élysée Palace. This is despite his replacement, his successor, Emmanuel Macron, being the new incumbent of the Élysée for more than a month. So why the wait? Well, Florence Biederman is the London Bureau Chief for AFP and she joins me now in the studio. Is this unusual for a president not to issue his official portrait for weeks on end?
It is. I mean, most of the time it comes after maybe 3-4 days, or I think Hollande waited something like 3 weeks, which was long already. But yeah, it's quite unusual, and it's really the way Mr. Macron is trying, I think, to control his own image. I mean, that's part of the game.
Well, we know it's going to be 50 centimetres by 65 centimetres, so it will hopefully replace the size of the photograph by François Hollande. But do we have any clue what the delay is down to? Has there been any explanation at all? And if not, what are people suggesting might be the delay?
The explanation was the Elysee said they were taking their time because they know there is a message in this picture always. Like, for example, François Hollande decided to have his picture taken in the garden of Elysee. It would be less formal than what his predecessor, Nicolas Sarkozy, had done. He was in the library.
That was a pretty pompous picture, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was. I mean, it was an allusion also to François Mitterrand, the former president, who was quite a literate man. I'm not so sure Sarkozy was so fond of books because he criticized once the fact that you had to study classic at school. So anyway, he wanted to be to pose as a serious man, so that's why he took this picture. So it's always a message. And then what will come out of Emmanuel Macron's picture is really something that everybody's waiting for. So I guess the fact that you are waiting for it is also part of the game.
This is a man who seems to have been extremely certain of his fate. There just seems to be no doubt in it. And is anybody mentioning the word vanity yet?
No, we prefer to speak in France of Jupiterian president so far. You know, he has been compared to the God of Gods. So there is a little irony in it. Don't laugh. But no, vanity, yeah, some of his critics would say he's probably too much self-centered. There was some kind of people trying to have psychological explanation of this man, but nobody really knows him well enough to be sure of the answers.
How successful is the image of each president when it is issued around the French official buildings? I mean, you talked about Nicolas Sarkozy trying to sort of reflect the idea of François Mitterrand. François Hollande chose a photograph or a photographer who very much wanted to be a sort of an ordinary natural picture when he was in the grounds of the Elysee Palace. Look what that did for him. I mean, is there a necessity for a president to appear to be in charge of the public in his photograph?
It's certainly what the French expect from the president. It's linked also to our political system of the Fifth Republic, where the president has lots of power. So what happened with Hollande is he was the normal president, but he was so much normal that after 5 years, you know, he didn't look like a president anymore. So obviously, Emmanuel Macron has a different strategy. He learned from this. He's not as much in touch with the journalist as his predecessor was. And obviously, he wants to take some distance and some height.
He clearly needs to take some height. In terms of the relationship with the press, it did not start well. Do you think that it has improved in any way? And this sort of holding back the photograph will improve or worsen relationships with the press?
It didn't start well because there was this feeling that the Élysée was choosing the journalist that was supposed to accompany Emmanuel Macron for a trip to Mali. There was then, after some explaining of the Élysée, they said, no, not at all, we just wanted experts. So there was some kind of explanation. Let's wait and see. It's a bit early to know whether it will still continue or whether there will be an improvement. But definitely there is a real change of style with François Hollande because Hollande lost so much credibility talking too much to the press, to the point that there were like 5-6 books written on his presidency just when he left. And one of them did really damage his image. So obviously, Emmanuel Macron is much more careful with the journalist.
Let's have a look at what Le Monde is saying about him. It says Macron has decided to choose a government of experts. He's obviously gone for people. People who are not necessarily from, you know, well, he's chosen an entire government and politicians who haven't got any political experience. But this has not been a great week for him with the departure of several key figures. The departure of François Bayrou, for example, will have already done him some damage, do you think, before he's even got the first job done?
For sure, it was not good, but at least you could also say that he acted quickly, François Bayrou acted quickly. Nobody knows what really happened, but the damage that could have been done through a justice minister pleading for transparency that would himself been investigated for his party, a strange way of financing parliamentary assistance. So at least he acted quickly, and let's say there was some damage limitation. So I don't think it will really be a catastrophe for him. And as you said, like, he has been appointing experts. Also, this is something that may not shock the French people because they are so much defiant towards politicians. So why not try the new persons and have new people?
Indeed, which is what I think many people would have quite liked to do in other places in Europe. Florence Biedermann, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. That's all we have time for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. My thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, researchers Julien Goffin and Hanzadi Achikalin. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandes. The Monocle Daily returns at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.